There have been recent developments regarding Operation Kino.
Hello and welcome to Operation Kino, episode 111, the review segment for Friday, April 26th, 2013.
111.
I know.
Sorry, that just dawned on me. And we already recorded an episode where you said that number, and it didn't dawn on me then.
This proves how little you listen to me.
I know, that's true.
As you might guess from our rambling, we do not have a special guest tonight, but we do have Dave back for a review, so maybe you're like a special guest.
I'm special.
Yeah,
Dave is pretty special.
You haven't been on... You haven't done a review with us, I guess, since we started the new format.
Yeah, usually Fridays are my day off. All days are actually my day off, except
That's
for
true.
Tuesdays.
Oh, hire Dave if you have any job openings.
Oh.
Well, I don't think we can thank your unemployment for you coming to see Pain and Game with us, but I'm glad that you did anyway.
No, it did make me think a lot more about if I should be invested in fitness.
Really?
It's a mixed message.
Well, you're not very patriotic. For not being into fitness. So.
That's true. Mark Wahlberg does say, if you are not fit, it's unpatriotic.
Yes.
That's true.
I don't know if I said it out loud.
I do like movies that talk about being American, which I guess we're going to talk
about
today. That's
why you briefly worked for AmericanReview.com.
Yeah, that's not what I mean, Patches.
Oh, sorry.
But I think that, films that talk some way about what America felt like at a certain time period through crime or through like a weird perspective, like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, I think is always interesting.
Well, I would say that Pain and Gain is definitely that kind of movie, and it sounds like you agree with me. I don't think it has a ton to say about the 90s, but the 90s setting is very important to it. It at least influences the fashion. Dave, since you haven't done this in a while, I'm going to make you do the plot synopsis because I get sick of hearing myself talk.
Okay, so Mark Wahlberg plays a character named Daniel Lugo who has already on probation for sort of running some sort of scam with getting investments for old people in exchange for loans that he doesn't work out. That's very quickly established through voiceover, and now he's working as a fitness manager. We see him climb to the role of fitness manager at this gym. And he's talking about how fitness is important to him and being American is important to him. And we sort of see him worn down by just seeming like he should have everything in his mind, but having not a lot because he's really just this fitness manager at an okay gym with a criminal past. And he hatches this scheme when he runs into Tony Shalhoub's character, who I forget what his name is.
Kershaw.
Victor Kershaw,
who is sort of this small guy at the gym but talks a big game and seems like he's sort of a maybe white collar criminal and has offshore bank accounts and whatnot. And Victor decides through a Ken Jeong leadership seminar that he wants everything that Tony Shalhoub has, so that gets him to put together a ragtag heist group of himself, Dwayne "The Rock" Johnson, who plays a born-again Christian ex-con, and Anthony Mackie, who plays a bodybuilder who has a little bit of erectile dysfunction and really doesn't want to work at the taco place he's been working
at. A little bit of erectile dysfunction.
Well, it seems like a pretty dramatic one, actually.
I think he's suffering quite heavily from that.
As serious as you could take erectile dysfunction in a Michael Bay movie, this guy has it.
Michael Bay does love his erectile dysfunction jokes, that is true. And penis jokes in general. There are a lot of penises in this movie.
And off color. Just off color, I think, is the broad stroke you should claim.
Man,
there.
He
because
hates
there are poop
fat
jokes,
people.
And there are fat people jokes, and there are midget jokes, and none of that plays, but none of that really feels like it's part of the movie that was written by these two guys, Christopher Marcus and Stephen McFeely, who wrote Captain America, the First Avenger, which is awesome.
You only like this movie because it's written by the guys who made Captain America?
Well, I think the script is really smart versus... I think the script for Pain and Gain is really smart. And I think Michael and Bay infuses it with the style necessary to complement the script. But then he kind of peppers it with all of his Michael Bay-isms that detract from it truly being great.
You think that detracts and doesn't add? I'll give you the midget because the midget doesn't
make any
sense.
And the shit joke. The shit joke was especially unnecessary and offensive.
Yes. Okay. There's a few things in there that probably didn't need to be in there that are the Bumblebee peeing on John Turturro of this movie.
Or the Transformer balls over John Turturro of this movie is how I thought of it.
There are a couple roles that are John Turturro-ish in this movie that just have to have things like piled on them. But stuff like the fat jokes and the fact that they like hang out in like strip clubs and weird misogynic places, and that we're dealing
right.
with these.
Dwayne Johnson's character hates gay people. So
yeah,
but you know, I think Michael Bay has demonstrated slightly homophobic humor in the past, but again, it's complemented here because his characters are total douchebag assholes, and
yeah.
they should feel that way and they should think this way because we're not supposed to be sympathetic for them. I mean, I think this movie is, we're laughing at the main characters the whole way through, and it's a very nihilistic approach to making a movie that we don't see very often, but I think it's well executed in that manner.
The movie does slip a little ways into, I think what makes this movie so successful for me is that it allows all of this nihilistic crazy shit to happen, and it is in the guise of the characters. Like, most of the time that you're seeing something offensive or you're seeing something weird or violent is happening because these guys are morons. But I think Michael Bay doesn't totally separate himself from it. Like, you were talking about how the Rock's character hates gay people and beats up this guy, but there's also the scene with the kind of effeminate manager of the gun store where they tase him for no apparent reason, and that it's just funny to see the effeminate guy getting tased.
Oh, anybody getting tased is funny. Come on.
But the fact that he's effeminate is definitely part of the joke as well, which is, although he also has this funny Christian Rock sing-along with The Rock that's legitimately hilarious.
Now, we're kind of digging into the bad parts of Pain and Gain.
That's
but
true.
I think when we left the theater, Katie, one of the things that you said right away was, this was almost great.
Yeah, I still
Please
stand by
explain
that.
Yourself. What went very right with Pain and Gain?
I think it's this incredible satire. It's this way of Michael Bay making a movie about really, really dumb people, then the same way that the Coen brothers do. I mean, people say that the Coens are mean to their characters sometimes, and Michael Bay is very blatantly mean to his characters. He thinks these guys are idiots. He's going to exploit their idiocy for laughs for the sake of the audience. And this, the way that it, you know, he puts the American flags in the background of every shot the way he does in every movie, but in this, it's kind of fits into this poison vision of the American dream where you've got these old people who are baking away in the sun, and you've got these morons like Mark Wahlberg who are trying to accomplish something by doing the least amount of work possible. It nails the satire tone and the comedy tone in this way that I never would have thought Michael Bay could do. And except for those, you know, occasional off-color jokes that don't land at all, it's really
funny. That's why I think the script functions so well, because this movie is meant to be, it's meant to look and feel like a Michael Bay movie. I mean, once again, almost every shot is a low-angle shot that's making these guys look like kings. But with this script behind them, they're oafs. They're just,
yeah.
They're delusional. And there's all, you know, we're in Miami. We're with the meatheads who love girls with big titties, fake titties at the strip club. And, like, that's supposed to be...
Sound like you have experience in this world.
Well, I was doing my Spring Breakers impression a little bit there. But, you know, that... on one hand, if you watch a Transformers movie, I mean, the infamous Transformers 2 shot of Megan Fox over that motorcycle was heinous in its depiction of women, and I think. And in this movie, we need those shots in order to just see how sick these dudes are, or the
yeah.
culture there. I mean, Michael Bay seems like he's born from the culture that he's criticizing in some ways in this film.
Yeah.
Isn't it more like The Informant, where like the movie is in the perspective of these guys,
yeah,
even
okay.
though you're aware
yeah.
that they're an idiot,
but
it's okay to do some of those things?
But his style that we've seen in past movies is complementing it.
Yes.
So, I mean,
as
what does that mean?
That he's presenting the real world like he was in Transformers, where you can ogle Megan Fox's ass and be like, oh, no, that's what the audience wants. Like, this movie puts it from their perspective, so it gives you all this idiocy and teaches you more about the characters at the same time and doesn't implicate the audience in a lot of the gross stuff that happens.
It also allows all the people involved to be over the top. And, you know, one of the things I think works against some of other films by Michael Bay is that, you know, his worlds are heightened, but he has his actors just act normal.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going along for the crazy ride. He wants them to be naturalistic. I think about The Island and how serious that movie is, even though the way he makes the movie is not serious. It's over the top and bombastic. Whereas here, Mark Wahlberg is, you know, amping up the faces he was making in The Happening to, like, the nth degree. He's going insane. He's pumping you up like Arnold Schwarzenegger, or better yet, those Saturday Night Live spoofs of Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's like, we'll pump you up. And Dwayne Johnson gets to play a crackhead, or I guess he's a cokehead, who's just it goes off the rails. Like, seeing this scene when he finally, you know, he is sober in this movie for a while, and, you know, thanks to millions of dollars that land on his lap, he gets to indulge in cocaine again. And those scenes are insane. He just goes crazy. And seeing The Rock do this kind of comedic slapstick shtick is incredible. And Anthony Mackie, too, a person I'm not thinking of as, like, a real comedic force, just nails, like, he has such a rapport with, oh, God, why am I forgetting
Rebel Wilson?
Rebel Wilson, yeah. Who, again, not someone I'm thinking is, who might be too over the top in some of the movies that I've seen her in the past, fits perfectly with him, and just, like, this whole dialogue about his problems and erectile dysfunction, getting shots in the penis, or he drinks breast milk infused with steroids to perfectly enhance his pecs. I mean, all this stuff is just insane, and finally Michael Bay lets the actors, or has a reason to let the actors, go crazy. And I mean, so crazy that Ken Jeong makes sense in this movie.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing that we haven't mentioned yet, because it doesn't get revealed so far in this movie, is that Ed Harris is the cop that is chasing him, and he and his wife are the only two characters that don't have a shade of being assholes in them, really.
Yeah.
And so, for me, that complicated a little bit, in the sense that, in terms of the unity I like in movies that I would describe as, like, super great movies, it was hard for me to fit the way they treated Ed Harris into it, because it's like, he's not as American dreamy. Maybe he's, like, living some sort of, you know, what everybody thinks is the American dream, and he's bored by it and has to, like, get back into crime. But that's not as compelling as everybody else who's, you know, grasping at it in these wild madcap scenes.
To me, he's the emissary from our actual planet. He's not a particularly well-rounded character, but I don't think he needs to be. And I might have talked to one of you guys about this. They use the persona of Ed Harris for him to show up on screen. And the minute he shows up, like, about an hour through, you see him for the first time, and you're immediately like, oh, shit, it's over. These guys are never going to make it. And he's just there as this kind of calming, like, steady presence in this insane world, so that you know that this world's going to fall apart, that it's not really realistic.
When the cops from Miami can't get their shit together, Ed Harris is standing around going, like, I'm just telling you the truth. Like, this is how the real world operates. It's right in your eye line.
Ed Harris is the closest thing you have to an audience surrogate in this. And even though, you know, he's following the information, he doesn't know everything that we do, he exists from our planet. And Michael Bay seems to really realize that and use him for that exclusively.
Yeah.
Do you think the first hour of this movie is getting, like, gets that detached from reality, that we're going to need that grounding point for the second half?
I think so, because the amount of torture we see Tony Shalhoub go through. I mean, one of the funniest scenes of the movie is when we see these guys try and kill him off. Like, they're pushing and trying, like, they're done with this guy. They've extorted him. And obviously, this is only, like, maybe 40 minutes into the movie. That's how far this movie escalates over the course of its 2 hour and, like, 20 minute runtime.
I think we can all agree.
Way too long. Yeah, but it's hysterical to see them, like, push him and, you know, we're going to put him in a car and slam it into a wall. No, put in his seatbelt, and then they light it on fire. No, he got out of the car, but he's on fire and he's okay. No, smush his head. No, we can't do anything right. And I think you definitely see that the escapades go nuts and escalate. I think that's the key word here. Just, like, it keeps building and building and getting crazier. When they get the money and they start buying things, and again, watching Dwayne Johnson go from, like, sober inmate Jesus freak who sings arias in his free time to a guy who sniffs a mountain of coke and hangs out with Miss Belarus or wherever she's from, and just, it goes crazy. And Michael Bay obviously is there to follow them with his crazy camera work.
Yeah.
In terms of somebody who I've, on a recent lightning round question, put back into TV land, why does something like this work where something like Horrible Bosses, which has similar premises, doesn't go anywhere?
It's Horrible Bosses has no style. That's why you do have to give Michael Bay a little credit here. I mean, the colors and the camera work. I like seeing Michael Bay use some of these kind of, and I don't know if he's done it in the Transformers movies. I was trying to recall while watching if I'd seen this before, but he kind of does the, oh my God, I'm losing my mind, the Jake Gyllenhaal End of Watch camera work where it's we're going to strap you on.
He's got like grainier digital cameras attached to like the
Well, like put it on a gun or put it on a door or put it on your face as you're running around. And that was really compelling to see him kind of scale down and do that. You know, there isn't really a big action scene in this this movie. You get a little chase stuff when the police end up pursuing them a bit, but nothing on the scale that we've seen Michael Bay do before, but the whole movie still feels kinetic. We're always moving. We're always on this journey with them. And I love that the script ends up being, it serves that too. Like, we're always hearing a voiceover. We're always hearing Mark Wahlberg do this, like, mentor voiceover to himself. Like, you're a doer. You can do anything. People are telling you you're wrong, but they're wrong. You're right. You know, the encouraging voice is so haunting and so miserable because it just spirals out of control.
Yeah, and everybody, I mean, he's not the only one with a voiceover, and even, like,
everyone,
beyond...
Even the chick gets voiceover.
What did you think of that, by the way? Because bouncing back and forth between people, at first I was a little off-put by it, but I like that it seems like we're recounting this story. That seems faithful almost to the articles that it's based on.
Yeah,
I think it's what you were saying about the needing the kineticism, but also needing to have enough background on these characters to let them, you know, Three Stooges out without having no character base. And I really enjoyed these quick flashes that, I mean, a lot of my synopsis about his crime at the beginning comes from the articles, not necessarily what we were shown, because we're only shown that he pulled like some sort of scam and went to jail, and they're really efficiently dealt with.
Yeah, and it gives you kind of still the idea that this is everyone putting their hopes and dreams into whatever's happening here. And you contrast, you know, each individual character's voiceover with, at the very beginning, you get Ed Harris as this voice of God voiceover saying, unfortunately, this is based on a true story. He exists outside the narrative. He knows how all of this is going to turn out. And that is another way to kind of separate him and put him in a different film than these yahoos who are, you know, talking into the audience's ear about how this is going to solve all their problems.
I think it's important to note, because I was describing this film to someone afterward, and I didn't realize it really while watching it because I was being entertained, but I was describing it and it sounded very gross to them. This is a disgusting movie, because it's pretty bloody and violent and like intense sometimes. I mean, the stuff that they put Tony Shalhoub through, but the stuff that happens later in the film, I mean, it definitely ramps up the violence more than I guess I didn't even know this was rated R, which it must be, right?
Yeah, oh, definitely.
Yeah.
I think that's another credit to Bay, and that, you know, when they're getting to the scene where they're trying to kill Tony Shalhoub, and these are guys that you're rooting for. And if it's the hero dispatching the bad guy, you're not going to see the blood and you're not going to suffer through the process of him being killed. But he really makes you suffer through it. He doesn't let you forget the horrible shit that these guys are doing the entire time, which is, I think, a lot more responsible than I ever would have credited Michael Bay for.
Yeah, it really amps up how stupid these characters are when you see them go through this process rather than just if they were to end up with the end solution. Because they sort of get really close to getting away with it. And so, but it's in seeing the process and how like luck's sort of on their side for a little while and then it just stops that adds the, you know, I guess, farcical nature to the second half of the movie.
Yeah.
So, Katie, I guess to kind of wrap up, you said it was not great, but it could have been great. It's close to great. Why is it reaching but doesn't quite get it?
That's a lot of the stuff we talked about already. The you know, terrible jokes that show up where and it starts.
Does that
off
really like, derail it for you? I mean, in a movie that has so much girth.
Well, yeah, the girth is another problem. It's too long. It's too unfocused. Like, there's an entire scene where Mark Wahlberg's doing the neighborhood watch thing, and he's teaching all the neighbors to protect themselves from attackers, and there's all these random rape jokes, and, like, it's a combination of both bad jokes and the movie being too bloated. I mean, I think but it's all technical stuff. I mean, I think the vision of this movie is completely intact. It's just a matter of actually executing it and kind of nailing every scene, and he comes really close, but he doesn't quite get there.
Dave.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds pretty accurate. I'm more just happy that, you know, we didn't lose the Michael Bay that, you know, was able to make The Rock super entertaining into a whole bunch of, you know, Hasbro toy movies. Not that I dislike all of those Hasbro toy movies, but if you spend like a decade in a world where you don't have complete control over it, even for a control freak like a Michael Bay, I thought we might have lost something. And it looks like he's still capable of having fun and being relevant if he wants to, and that might mean he's just being stupid on purpose with some of his bigger movies, and
effectively using Gangsta's Paradise.
Yes, I thought. Very effective use of Gangsta's Paradise.
That's true.
That's what's important here.
Well, I think Pain and Gain could really have more robots in it, and Transformers movies could have more Coolio in them.
Everything needs more of The Rock, though. He's the best thing to add to your movie of this year.
I can't believe that he's not the one that came along with Bay to Transformers 4. Mark Wahlberg ended up. Rock is just doing. Well, I guess if you're in G.I. Joe, you can't also be in Transformers. So that they can cross over eventually.
I mean, I think what we're now all rooting for is for The Rock to show up at the end of the next Transformers movie and start that crossover.
Well, you obviously didn't stick around for the end credits scene of Pain and Gain.
Oh, man.
When Optimus Prime shows up. Spoiler alert!
Optimus Prime was actually Ed Harris all along. He's really perfected the transforming process.
Twist. He got plastic surgery.
I'm sure there's a lot of people who hated it.
There really are. I don't know. It's less racist than most of what he does, but it's homophobic and it's misogynistic, and yet it's also really good.
Somehow it's all of those things.
I know. I mean, it's rare that I can like see a movie that like makes a joke about a woman's pubic hair that I'm just like, all right, I'll see what you got.
But
else.
Should it count for more if you do? I mean, like, it should counts- we be taking those moments more seriously than we do?
When you've got a director who's got complete control, and obviously this is his vision, and you see stuff like that from him that he thinks belong, you do have to start questioning his judgment.
So we should be more critical of those moments in Pain and Gain, perhaps.
Well, I think you. Well, I mean, I don't know, but like more critical than what? Like more critical than
we're
we
kind of brushing those moments off a bit more than maybe we should.
Yeah,
because
I mean,
we
I
enjoy
think it,
the performances and the other action. And
well, and the directing overall is really good. I mean, the same brain that brings you this great direction also brings you those terrible jokes. You can't have one without the other.
Yeah, it's like hating your racist uncle.
You're
Michael
right.
Bay is America's racist uncle.
Yeah, that's essentially it. But he's like making the most money out of the family, and you don't want to piss him off.
Yeah, because he's going to give you some sweet inheritance. Although, yeah. what will Michael Bay leave us with?
But it'll
at
be blood
Transformers
money.
Toys.
It'll be blood money. That's the problem. Money.
Hey, Dave, what was our lightning round question?
What is Robin Williams' best movie? Simple, sweet. And do I also have to answer
Very
now
effective.
Immediately?
Well, you can stew on it if you need time. Or do you have a gut reaction? That might be best.
I mean, my personal reaction is going to be Aladdin just because it's, you know, burned into my mind.
Hey, that's
but
what I said.
I feel like nice. I should do something that I, you know, would be like a little more off the beaten path, but the truth is Aladdin. So I get to choose someone, right?
You went with the heart. Yeah, you should choose someone as well.
That's
yeah.
right.
Double,
good. I'm going to go
dipping.
With... Silber, whatever, who said, for pure fun, my pick might be Jumanji. I'm adverse to tweeting about it, lest some studio exec greenlight a sequel. I agree, but in terms of movies about board games, Jumanji was not that bad.
There already was a sequel.
There was? Well, Zathurusta? But that was just
no,
like a spiritual
Zathura.
Sequel.
Zathura.
Zathura.
Well,
Zathura.
I mean...
Thus spake Zathura.
Fair enough. Katie?
Spiritual sequel.
I'm going with Brandy Kaylee, who says, Mrs. Doubtfire, the image of him sticking his face in a pie and squealing, hello, will be forever ingrained in my mind.
Do things like a lady.
And, I mean, that movie, I don't even know how many times I've seen it because I think I have the whole thing memorized. So
did
clearly,
you discover that or Tootsie first?
Oh, Mrs. Doubtfire, for sure. It took me years to see Tootsie.
Did you discover James Bond or Pierce Brosnan in Mrs. Doubtfire first?
Was Pierce Brosnan already James Bond when Mrs. Doubtfire was made?
I don't think so. I would make a quick IMDb check.
I know. Well, why don't you come up with... I'm going to do that while you
Fair
pick
enough.
Your answer.
I'm going to be kind of a contrarian, because I'm not sure I 100% agree with this, but at osan912 said, as a child of the 90s, I'm obligated to say Aladdin, but let's be honest, it's probably Patch Adams. Which I'm not sure it probably is, but I vividly remember seeing Patch Adams in the movie theater with my family. Obviously, we had to go see it because Patch, duh.
Oh.
And then the best scene in the movie which I mention all the time to people, is when he puts an old woman in a big bowl of noodles and she squeezes them. And that is a perfect moment. That is cinema.
You guys, as a family, see any movie that has Patch in the title?
What other ones qualify there?
I don't know. Did you see the rejected Disney song from their sequel to Wizard of Oz they never made that's sung by a character named Patches?
I'm going to play that at our next family gathering.
Please do.
There's a movie called A Patch of Blue with Sidney Poitier and Shelley Winters. And then there's something called Miss Spider's Sunny Patch Friends.
We're going to have a Patch Davis Film Festival.
I know, at the Patches family homestead.
So what came first, James Bond or
Mrs. Doubtfire came out in 93 and Goldeneye came out in 95.
He's only Remington Steele at that point.
He was only Remington Steele, and he was also the victim of the run-by fruiting, which is term that I heard before I knew what a drive-by shooting was. So it was kind of went reverse on that. Also, is it not weird that a Pierce Brosnan James Bond movie came out in 2002? Doesn't that seem way too late?
No, man. He's forever.
Like diamonds.
Pierce Brosnan is forever.
I think that does it for today's Operation Kino. We'll be back next week with two episodes because that's how we do things these days. And Dave will be back in 10 more episodes to review something with us, maybe, if we're lucky.
I hope so.
Oh, yeah, we have Iron Man 3 next week, actually, so it's going to be a big one.
Oh, someone needs to let me see Iron Man 3.
Dave's already put all of Iron Man 3 on the web. So.
Oh, I mean, I could talk you guys through the plot right now.
Maybe we'll have you on, just you can tell us all the ways it's
different.
Yeah, that's not how I imagined it going down. I object.
In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find more of me at twitter.com/DA7E, and I guess you could also find more of us on Facebook at facebook.com/opkino.
You should pimp our other podcast, Dave.
Patches and I have been doing a podcast with Scott Biggs from Broken Projector and Mike Sampson of Screen Crush and Michelle of Brightwall Dark Room, and we're covering Adventure Time, and you could find that at podcasttime.com.
Awesome. And I am Matt Patches. I'm the movies editor of Hollywood.com. Find me on Twitter at Mr. Patches. And yeah.
And I'm Katie Rich. You can find me here at Cinema Blend or on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. You can also follow us on Twitter at Opkino. And we'll be back talking to you next week.
Mr. Aladdin, sir, have a wish of two or three. I'm on the job.
You big nabob.
You ain't never had a friend, never had a friend. You ain't never had a friend, never had a friend. You ain't never had a friend. You never had a friend like me.